vanished as Florida real estate consumed the once vast prairie. Now they may be the next bird to go extinct in the U.S. if remedies are not quickly discovered. Scientists and activists involved fear that humanity may have waited too long to act on what is clearly coming. My name is Cheyenne Sun Thunder, and this is Small World Radio Production.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Welcome to WBAI Playhouse and a story which revisits a dark chapter of American history, the internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans and the fight for justice in their name. For Us All by Jeannie Sakata chronicles the fight by a team of lawyers to overturn the conviction of three Japanese Americans unjustly sentenced for resisting the World War II mass incarceration of all Japanese Americans on the West Coast. This as the government uses every tactic to make the case go away. It's the story of Frank Korematsu and his fight for justice. According to a member of his legal team, Don Tamaki, Fred Korematsu's eventual court victory taught America about the fragility of civil rights, especially during times of international tensions. And it reinforces our belief that civil rights must be fought for and are not simply guaranteed by the courts or by any governmental institution. Here's a little background from Korematsu's lawyers. During World War II, he was a 22-year-old welder in Oakland, California. He defied military orders. It ultimately led to the internment of thousands upon thousands of Japanese Americans, including Korematsu and his family. They were removed from their homes, held first in the Tan Foran Racetrack Assembly Center in San Bruno, California, and then incarcerated in the Topaz Internment Center in Utah. He took his challenge to the military orders to the U.S. Supreme Court, which in 1944 upheld his conviction on the ground. Removal of Japanese Americans was justified by military necessity. That decision has been widely condemned as one of the darkest chapters in American legal history. After four decades of having to live with a disloyalty conviction on his record that limited him from securing full-time work, Korematsu filed suit to reopen his case on proof that the government, when arguing his case during the war, had suppressed, altered, and destroyed material evidence that contradicted the government's claim of military necessity. In 1984, the Federal District Court for the Northern District of California granted his petition for a writ of coram nobis, that's a notice of error, and vacated his conviction. Korematsu went on to champion the cause of civil liberties, not only seeking redress for Japanese Americans who were wrongfully interned, but also traveling the country to advocate for civil rights. He passed away in March of 2005 at the age of 86, but his case remains a testament to the importance of preventing the erosion of civil liberties in the cause of national security. And now we go to LA Theater Works for this production of For Us All by Jeannie Sakata. Here's Susan Loewenberg.
The play draws inspiration from enduring conviction, Fred Korematsu and His Quest for Justice by Lorraine K. Benai, and Justice Delayed by Peter Irons. For Us All is sponsored by the California Civil Liberties Public Education Program, a state-funded grant project of the California State Library. And now, For Us All by Jeannie Sakata, directed by Annalise Erickson. Starring Edward Asner, Brooke Ishibashi, Tess Lina, Mike McShane, Derek Mio, Joy Osmansky, Jeannie Sakata, Andre Soluzzo, Josh Stamberg, Greg Watanabe, and Paul Yen. Produced by LA Theatre Works.
September 1981. Dust covering the three boxes. That's what I remember. The original files from the Supreme Court cases of Fred Korematsu, Minoru Yasui, and Gordon Hirabayashi. Three young Americans who, during World War II, challenged government orders from military curfew and the banishment of their communities to barbed-wired prisons in the desert. A mass incarceration of over 100,000 Japanese Americans. I was deeply moved by the courage of these young men,
In 1942, all three were convicted of criminal acts in federal courts. All three appealed, their cases going to the Supreme Court, on the grounds that confining a group of Americans because of ancestry alone was unconstitutional. All three lost. I wanted to know why. On top of the boxes, someone wrote, United States Justice Department. They sat here, undisturbed, for four decades. A few days earlier. Hello?
Dr. Peter Irons?
Speaking?
We found him.
You did?
In a warehouse up in Baltimore.
Oh, that's terrific.
Some idiot misfiled them 40 years ago.
Where were they filed?
At the U.S. Commerce Department.
The Commerce Department? How on earth did...
No idea. Crazy, right? You'd almost think someone went and hid them there on purpose. The Commerce Department? Nobody will find them here.
So how...
Pure incompetence. Those cliches about government employees. I mean, just think. If it weren't for you, they'd be lying around lost for decades. Oh, wait. They already have been. Good luck.
I jumped in a taxi to the Commerce Department, and another stroke of luck. The clerk in charge of my Freedom of Information request was out sick. Now, I hated to be happy over someone else's misfortune, but since that clerk had the power to screen the records before I saw them and possibly deny my request, I could sidestep the usual protocol. Layers of grime and dust covered the three boxes. I took out my handkerchief and wiped the top of the first. Someone had written in black marker the case name.
Korematsu versus the United States.
I undid the twine, opened the box, took out the first paper on top. A memo from a Justice Department lawyer named Edward Ennis, addressed to then Solicitor General of the United States, Charles Fahey.
We're in possession of information
that shows the War Department's report is a lie. And we have an obligation not to lie to the Supreme Court.
A lie?
Now, the government is arguing it was not possible to screen Japanese Americans individually. But Lieutenant Ringel's report directly contradicts that argument.
Lieutenant Ringel, from the Office of Naval Intelligence, who had intimate knowledge of the Japanese American community.
Ringel states, the Japanese who would act as saboteurs is estimated to be less than 3% of the population. And the most dangerous are already in custody or identifiable.
Only 3%?
In short, the entire Japanese problem has been magnified out of proportion. It should be handled on the basis of the individual.
Unbelievable.
Had we known of Ringel's views, we could have urged General DeWitt he could not base a military judgment to the contrary upon intelligence. The Justice Department is now representing the Army at the Supreme Court. Failure to provide the Ringel report would be a breach of the government's duties. We must advise the court of its existence. Any other action might approximate the suppression of evidence.
Holy smokes.
I had just found evidence of a government cover-up at the Supreme Court. A few weeks before my discovery, I began researching the cases in the National Archives for a book I hoped to write.
Sorry, sir. You'll have to wait. Someone else is using those files.
Oh. Do you know if it's going to be a long wait?
Well, yeah, if the last 3 years are any indication. See, this lady who's got them, she's been here like clockwork, Monday through Saturday, every day for the last 3 years. Everything she checks out, she pores over for days, makes copious notes. She must have spent a fortune in Xeroxing.
You don't say. Well, I'm only going to be here a few days, so...
So you better be nice to her.
Right. Is she...
Right over there.
Her head was bent over a book with piles of documents around her. She was scribbling away furiously on a yellow legal pad.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Those papers you're looking at.
Yes?
I was hoping to look at them today, too. And...
Well, you'll have to wait your turn.
Yes, of course.
I should be finished soon. But not immediately, so you might want to get some lunch.
Lunch? Sure, good idea. Is there a place you'd recommend?
Well, you've got to be more specific. What kind of place?
Oh, anything will do.
That's not very specific.
I can just eat in the cafeteria.
Now, where did I put my purse? Oh, there it is. Hiding. Okay. Here's a pamphlet listing all the nearby restaurants. Just ignore all my scribbling.
That's a very impressive list of annotations and footnotes.
Well, I've worked here for 3 years. You gotta know the lunch specials. You like Italian?
Love it.
I'd recommend the chicken parmigiana at Saldino's. Mm. Lunch special, free garlic bread. But that's only for the lunch special. Otherwise, you pay for the garlic bread.
Thanks. Much appreciated.
Say, hope I'm not being nosy, but may I ask what you want these documents for?
Well, I'm writing a book on the legal challenges to the Japanese-American prison camps.
No kidding. Well, sit down. What's your name?
Dr. Peter Irons. I'm a legal studies professor at the University of Massachusetts.
And you're writing about what happened to us.
Oh. I take it that you were...
in the prison camps when I was just a teenager. That's why I'm here, you see. Every day, every week, to find out why it happened. How it happened. Who made it happen.
That's why I'm here, too.
Good. Pleased to meet you, Dr. Irons. I'm Aiko Hitsig Yoshinaga.
Please, call me Peter.
So, you must know a lot of Nihonjin.
A lot of... what?
Nihonjin. Oh, you don't know what that means?
Sorry, I don't speak Japanese. Is that Japanese?
It is. Okay, I just assumed since you were writing a book...
I probably should know that.
Yes, I think you should. It means Japanese person or people. Singular or plural.
Oh. You're actually the first Japanese person I've ever met.
The first?
Wait, a second. I met a Japanese guy in college protesting the military draft, but then we got arrested and I...
Okay, let's just back up a little here. If you've only met two of us in your entire life, and one of them literally a minute ago, why are you writing this book?
Because, Aiko, these decisions were terribly unjust. No matter what ethnicity you are, these rulings should worry us all. And as a law professor, as an American citizen, it's something I want, need to know more about. And so, I think, should all Americans.
Hey, that's a damn good answer. Now, what's this about getting arrested?
For resisting the draft, yeah. Ended up spending 3 years in jail.
3 years? So, your book, These Cases, I'm beginning to get the picture. Mm. Have you heard of the CWRIC? The Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians.
Yes. I've been closely following their work.
Well, I'm their chief researcher.
Oh.
And we're working like heck to get survivors to testify and tell their stories. But it is pretty doggone hard. Too much pain.
Yes. I've heard. You were imprisoned as a teenager.
Eloped with my boyfriend the night before and shot the heck out of my parents. We were afraid the government would separate us, you see. The next day, they shipped us off to Manzanar in the Mojave Desert. I got pregnant, had my baby, then transferred to Jerome, Arkansas, so my father could meet his granddaughter. He died 10 days later, Christmas Day, 1943.
I'm sorry to hear.
After Manzanar, 2 husbands and 3 children later, I married Jack Herzig, a retired Army officer who'd served in counterintelligence. After our move to D.C., we started coming here every day to research the prison camps. The more I read, the angrier I got. And now with the CWRIC, we'll do something about this mess. Hey, Peter, you want to team up?
How's that?
Share resources. Compare notes. Going through all this stuff, lots of legal questions come up. You can help me with those. And for you, well, I can show you everything I've found in the archives so far.
Yes, yes, great.
Trust me. After 3 years, I know every nook and cranny of this place. I know it better than my own kitchen cupboard.
Aiko, a former housewife and devoted church secretary, trained herself to become a skilled archival researcher by the time she started her work with the CWRIC.
So, Aiko, the correspondence concerning the magic cables...
I'll be box 9 by the Picasso print.
Wow. Okay. The January memos from Lieutenant Ringel.
Ringel papers, boxes 9 through 21, aisle M.
And the revised draft of Public Proclamation 93 that Attorney General Biddle...
You need special clearance for that one, but let me save you some trouble. I've got a copy in my bathtub.
Your bathtub?
I've collected so many documents, I've turned my bathtub into a filing cabinet.
No kidding.
And I hate giving up my bathtub, because I'm Japanese and you know we love our baths.
Aiko and I made a good team. She was the passion fueling our work, and I was the legal advisor. Our partnership brought good times as I got to know her and her husband, Jack, the three of us sharing discussions, dinners, and beers. And now it brought us luck at the Department of Commerce.
Hello?
Aiko, you need to get here now.
Why?
I found some files belonging to the DOJ about the cases. No one's opened them for 40 years. Better not to say much more. If anyone here finds out what I've got, they'll confiscate them, so...
On my way.
Okay, I'm here. Where are they?
Here. Memos saying the War Department lied to the Supreme Court in a report claiming military necessity for the mass incarceration.
What? Let me see.
Here.
It is of primary importance that we correct the misstatements of General DeWitt.
And here?
It is highly unfair to this racial minority that these lies go uncorrected.
And here?
There is no doubt that these statements were intentional falsehoods. Holy smokes!
You said it. Over the next week, Aiko and I pored over the Ennis memos and even more evidence that had been suppressed at the Supreme Court. Statements from the FBI and the FCC, transcripts of phone calls, all refuted the lies used to convict the three men. That Japanese Americans had committed acts of espionage, that their mass incarceration was essential to national security, and that the Army lacked sufficient time for individual trials of suspects. These lies had been promoted in the document Ennis mentioned, titled The Final Report. Issued from the War Department in 1942, its author was General John DeWitt,
Commander of the Western Defense Command. I hereby submit to you my final report on the Japanese evacuation from the West Coast. This evacuation was impelled by military necessity. The surprise attack at Pearl Harbor by the enemy crippled a major portion of the Pacific Fleet and exposed the West Coast to an attack. More than 115,000 persons of Japanese ancestry resided along the coast and were concentrated near many highly sensitive installations essential to the war effort. The continued presence of a large, unassimilated, tightly knit racial group, bound to an enemy nation by strong ties of race, culture, custom, and religion, constituted a menace which had to be dealt with. Their loyalties were unknown, and time was of the essence.
Peter.
Aiko, what is it?
I found a memo last year referring to the destruction of an original final report before it went to the Supreme Court. I have it here. Read it.
I have witnessed the destruction of galley proofs, memos, letters having to do with the first version of the final report signed Theodore Smith. An official under DeWitt?
Yes.
So this is a second final report? What was in the first? And why was it destroyed?
Don't you see?
Oh, my God, you really think that...
Yes, I do. And it worked, Peter. They doctored it up and it worked. Military necessity. Time was of the essence. The Supreme Court swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. So all of us in those miserable camps, whose lives had been destroyed, thousands and thousands of lives...
Aiko, your work matters. You matter. And if we can prove that the government covered...
Gotta go.
Where?
Modern military archives, to see if there's anything I missed.
Let me help you.
Smart man. Let's go stir up more trouble.
Hello again, Mrs. Herzog Yoshinaga. My, oh my, we're certainly seeing a lot of you this week.
Well, I aim to please. May I see...
John DeWitt's final report?
Yes.
Well, we've got a new copy. The archive has just cataloged it. A box brought up from the basement.
Thank you.
Aiko, here's a free table.
Peter, hold on. It's a different binder, this one.
Different?
Different from the ones holding the other final reports here in the archives. Notes.
What?
Here, scribbled in the margins, see? And look at this next page. Slashes through some of the sentences.
Delete. Suggested revision, delete, replace with.
Peter, look at this arrow pointing to this bracketed paragraph. All the text is crossed out. It was impossible to establish the identity of the loyal and the disloyal with any degree of safety. It was not that there was insufficient time. And look what's written below.
Suggested revision. Replace with.
To complicate the situation, no ready means existed for determining the loyal and the disloyal.
No mention of insufficient time?
None. Completely gone.
Meaning they knew they did have time for individual trials?
They're saying they did. Right here. Peter, it's the original final report. Before revisions were made. 10 copies were made, and 10 ordered destroyed, so I assumed I'd never... Oh, my God!
The smoking gun. The original final report. 1 copy, miraculously, had escaped the fire and was now in Iko's hands. And together with the Ennis memo, we now had overwhelming proof. The government had suppressed, altered, and destroyed evidence at the 3 men's Supreme Court trials. A few months later, my briefcase loaded with papers, I flew to San Francisco and made a call to San Leandro.
Hello?
Hello. Is this Mr. Fred Korematsu?
Speaking.
Mr. Korematsu, my name is Dr. Peter Irons.
Yes?
How do you do? It's a real honor to meet you. I'm on the faculty at the University of Massachusetts.
I see.
And I'm calling because I have been researching your legal challenge to Executive Order 9066.
Oh, well, that was 40 years ago.
I've gathered some documents together and made a discovery, which I think...
I don't talk about that anymore.
But...
I mean, from time to time, people ask me to talk about it, go to a group or class, and I used to try to do that because my wife thought I should.
I see.
Even went to UC Berkeley once, but I'm just not a very good speaker.
I understand. I've just arrived at the San Francisco airport, and I'm actually wondering if I could meet with you.
You're not a reporter, are you?
No. Could we arrange to meet? I really think these documents might be of great interest to you.
Well, it's a busy week. I'm chairman of the crab and spaghetti feed at our San Leandro Lions Club. And Sunday I'm flipping pancakes for our Presbyterian pancake breakfast. So, I'm sorry I can't meet you. And I really should be going now.
They could help reopen the Supreme Court case you lost 40 years ago.
Want to come by tonight?
I arrived at Fred's house, where he invited me to sit down. He was formal and polite, so was I. He had a tape recorder, so did I. So you see, Mr. Korematsu, the government had in sum lied to the Supreme Court in your case, engineered a win based on a false and fraudulent record. Here's a sample of what we found. A transcript of a phone call made by General DeWitt.
There isn't such thing as a loyal Jap. It is impossible to determine their loyalty by investigation.
Mm-hmm. And that was right before he wrote his final report.
May I see the rest of those papers?
Of course. I gave Fred the entire stack. He sat back, puffing on his pipe, reading them page by page for what seemed like an eternity. Finally, he looked up.
They did me a great wrong.
Yes.
Are you a lawyer?
I am.
Will you be my lawyer?
Mr. Korematsu, I'd be happy to be of help, but there are a lot of obstacles we'll encounter, lots of things that could go wrong, and it may take years.
Yeah. I've heard those words before.
I imagine you have.
I was just a shipyard welder when those Japanese planes attacked Pearl Harbor. I had a girlfriend then named Ida. She was Italian-American, and we were in love and planning to get married. When those orders came out that anyone with Japanese blood, including American citizens, had to pack up, sell everything, and clear out of San Francisco, I just couldn't leave her. She saw a doctor's ad for eyelid surgery, and I thought, hey, if I get that, maybe I can pass for being Filipino and stay. So I went and did it, but when I looked in the mirror, heck, I didn't look much different. A few days later, the police spotted us on a street corner and threw me in jail. After that, I never saw Ida again.
And then Ernie Bessig from the San Francisco ACLU, that's when he came to visit you?
Yes. He asked if I'd be willing to join them in challenging these orders. It could take years, he said. But right away, I said yes, because what was happening wasn't right. It just wasn't right to round us all up like we were the ones who bombed Pearl Harbor when we were loyal Americans. And then my Supreme Court case, well, you know the end of that. And over all these years, I'd think about my case from time to time. But then I finally said to myself, Fred, you lost. Your case is closed. There's nothing you can do about it.
There is no guarantee we will succeed, Mr. Korematsu.
I understand. I'll have to ask my wife, Catherine, and my kids, Karen and Ken.
Of course.
But I think I want to go ahead. And by the way...
Yes?
Call me Fred.
Fred was the last of the three men I called. Minya Sui and Gordon Hirabayashi had both given me the thumbs up and asked me to be their attorney as well. Now the campaign to reopen and reverse the cases began. The two men could not have differed more from Fred. Min, a fiery former military attorney. Gordon, a scholarly Quaker sociologist. But all three understood the enormous significance of this task. Never to my knowledge in American legal history had an effort been launched to overturn convictions in cases that had been finally decided by the Supreme Court. There was much to be done. I was a professor and a writer, not a litigator. I needed to find a legal team to help reopen the cases. I felt strongly that the cases should be brought by Japanese-American attorneys on the West Coast. These were cases that affected their communities, their families. Bay Area Attorneys for Redress, BAAR, was a group of mostly young Japanese-American attorneys in San Francisco, led by Dale Minami. A pioneering advocate for Asian-American civil rights, Dale had already litigated high-profile political cases. So I gave him a call.
Okay. Yeah, okay, got it. Thanks. Lori, can you come here for a sec?
There's all the research for the Musashi case, and our deadline's tomorrow, right? Now, who's that on the phone? Now, where do we put the witness list?
A guy named Peter Irons. He's researching legal challenges to the World War II prison camps. And there's a case he'd like us to work on, but...
But, let me guess, he wants us to do it pro bono, like the others who've called?
Well, as a matter of fact...
Did he say he has tons of evidence?
Well...
Ah! I wish we could say yes to everyone, but with only six of us here, this page needs our signature.
I know. We've heard it 1,000 times, but this case sounds different.
Different? How?
It's about Fred Korematsu.
As in Korematsu versus United States? What, as in the Fred Korematsu?
Yeah. I said to Irons, you mean he's still alive? But Irons said he just met with him. Also that he's been working for months with Aiko Herzig Yoshinaga.
Aiko? Head of research for the CWRIC?
Mm-hmm. And they've gathered some powerful stuff on the government in the Library of Congress. Hardcore evidence of lies told to the Supreme Court in the Korematsu case.
What? Wow. So, you actually think this Peter Irons is legit, don't you?
Let's just say I'm intrigued. Lori, we've known each other since Gardena days. Our parents were good friends. In all that time, did your folks ever talk about the prison camps?
Never.
Mine neither. I know they remember, though, a lot more than they care to admit. The only time I ever saw Mom cry was when she tried to talk about it, and...
Remember reading Korematsu for the first time in constitutional law class?
Sure. And thinking all Japanese Americans a national security threat? My mom and dad? My brother, 1 year old at the time? It's when I knew that Korematsu wasn't a case about justice. It was a case about power. Who had it and who didn't.
So, are you actually thinking that we...
Well, look, we've got to think this through. Because this case would take a lot of time, and we're only a staff of six. We're already working 60 hours a week, and we're backed up as it is.
And the pro bono thing. I mean, how many have you done already? The Wendy Yoshimura case, the Filipino international hotel workers, the Chinese-American racial profiling case.
We almost went broke on that one. And I do it all again in a heartbeat, but...
Plus, we just finished suing Washington State University over not having an Asian-American studies program.
And what about you, Lori? You're just a year out of law school, and now you're an associate here. Just now establishing yourself, still paying off student loans.
Dale, don't remind me.
And if this case takes years, which we know it will...
Goodbye, friends and family.
Oh, forget it. We'll never see them.
You just got married. Ouch.
Thanks a lot.
And I really don't visit my parents enough as it is. We've gotten so crazy busy here, it's getting harder and harder to drive down to Gardena.
Same here. And we should visit more. They're getting on now. They're slowing down. Sam Kai, Dad's friend from camp who fought with the 442, he just had a heart attack, and...
Dale?
Our parents. This could be our chance.
To vindicate them. We've got to do it.
You got the Rolodex, Lori?
Yep. Do we need expert litigators?
We need people who are smart as hell.
Asian Law Caucus?
Director Don Tamaki, please.
Please hold.
Dennis Hayashi is on staff there, too, with a new clerk, Margie Barrows.
Call Karen Kai and Bob Rusky. Bob's in this huge office with typing pools and Xerox machines.
Wow, the lap of luxury. Our machine just died, again.
Who else we got there on the list?
Akira Togasaki, Ed Chen, Leon Miyasato.
Don Tamaki?
Don, it's Dale. You thought about it? You in?
In. Way in and way ahead of you. Already up to speed on Korematsu. Let's call Eric Yamamoto, too.
Eric? Didn't he move to Hawaii?
Dale, what the hell? I've just been offered a partnership with my firm. I've been waiting years for this. And now I have to turn it down and move to San Francisco? Damn it!
Eric, you don't have to do this.
And miss a chance to work on a once-in-a-lifetime case? What are you, crazy? But I'll need a place near Chinatown, closer to Dim Sum Takeout.
See you in San Francisco.
The beginnings of a legal team grew as Dale and Lori recruited many attorney friends, all eager to work on this case, most of whom had watched their own parents suffer the horrors of Executive Order 9066. As Fred's team shaped up in San Francisco, Dale was designated lead counsel. In Portland, Peggy Nagaye, assistant dean of the University of Oregon School of Law, agreed to be lead counsel for Min Yasui. And in Seattle, Gordon Hirabayashi tapped Catherine Banai, civil rights attorney and redress activist, to lead his team, who also happened to be Lori's sister.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York. You're listening to For Us All by Jeannie Sakata on WBAI Playhouse, produced by LA Theater Works.
I flew to San Francisco the weekend of May 8, 1982. Dale, Lori, and their first recruit, Don Tamaki, waited to meet me at the airport.
This is For Us All by Jeannie Sakata on WBAI New York.
Sorry I'm late. Delayed delivery.
You finally got a new desk?
Come on. When we started the ALC back in 72 and you were a volunteer, all you had was a cheap office door thrown across two sawhorses.
A step up from the pull-down desk in your hippie Volkswagen bus.
Oh, yeah. The good old days. When I showed up to court in a pair of jeans and told the judge someone stole my suit.
Well, now that I'm in charge of the ALC, we'll spiff things up just a bit.
Guys, I'm psyched.
I'm gonna withhold my judgment till I meet this Irons guy. Gather some intel first.
Don, you ever get a gut feeling about someone? Just go with the flow?
The flow is overrated.
Ooh, is there a story here? One with a sordid twist?
Mr. Don Tamaki, Mr. Never Loses His Cool. I roomed with this guy for a year, and he never drank more than two beers at a time.
Not gonna bite. Okay, I'll bite. Mr. Never Met a Beer I Didn't Like.
That's just to keep up with Lori.
Ah!
And this is why I need to rely on cold, objective facts. What did this Irons guy sound like on the phone? What sort of vibe did you get?
I just hope he's not some stodgy, square, Ivy League professor type in a corduroy sports coat with elbow patches.
God, no.
Hello, Dale Manami?
Peter Irons?
How do you do? And you are?
Lori Badnai.
Don Tamaki.
Oh, it's good to meet you all.
So, your flight go okay? Anything you need?
I need a beer. And quick, is that a bar over there?
Don, I think we're all going to get along fine.
And at Antioch College, I joined the youth branch of the NAACP. Worked on the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Then I protested the Vietnam War, sent back my draft card, and told them, I'm not coming. Got arrested and jailed for 3 years, but later learned the draft board had illegally moved up my draft date, so I filed a coram nobis case to vacate my own conviction.
Coram nobis? What the hell is that?
Okay, I think that's the legal vehicle we can use to reopen these cases. A petition for writ of error, coram nobis.
Huh, never heard of it.
I hadn't heard about it at Harvard Law. That's how rare it is.
Coram nobis. What does it mean?
Literally, before us, a petition that seeks relief for an error of the most fundamental nature committed before the court that results in manifest injustice. It's a very rare option, only for people who, for example, can prove the government engaged in misconduct at the time of their trials.
How'd you find out about it?
I was browsing the shelves of the law library looking for a way to get my conviction reversed. And in the federal code, I stumbled onto the All Writs Act 28 U.S.C. 1651 and this mention of coram nobis. Eureka, there it was. I put together a petition, attached incriminating documents, and filed it by mail to the U.S. District Court. The federal judge granted my petition, and my conviction was expunged.
Huh. This is incredible.
You think this could really work?
I'd say it's a long shot, but it may be the best shot we have.
Wait, what court would we file in? The trial court, the courts of appeal, or the Supreme Court?
How would we introduce 40-year-old evidence?
Would we file one joint petition or three separate petitions?
Guys, all in good time. Let's get out there and get the answers one by one. For Fred, Min, Gordon, for our families, for us. Let's play ball.
May 1982. Later that month, a few of us met Fred and his family at his home.
You're going to work on Dad's case for free?
Dad, they're not going to do anything without you paying.
Karen, please, just hear us out.
No, I don't understand this pro bono thing. I don't get it at all. You guys are just starting out in your careers. How can you afford to work for free? What's in it for you?
Actually, a lot. Before the war, my dad was just about to graduate from UC Berkeley. My grandparents had sacrificed everything to get him there, but said it would all be worth it the day he got his degree. Then they got thrown out of their home by Executive Order 9066 and ordered into a cramped horse stall on the Tanforan racetrack, which still reeked from horse manure streaked on the walls.
Wow.
Someone knocked on the door. Dad opened it, and a soldier handed him a cardboard tube with his UC degree. And my grandmother burst into tears. Because instead of graduating at UC Berkeley with all the family applauding, here Dad was getting his degree as a prisoner in a horse stall. I still have that cardboard tube on my desk. So, to be able to reopen Fred's case after so many years, to maybe vindicate our families too, to be perfectly honest, I would pay to be on this team.
Thank you, Don. Peter, could I have a private word?
Of course.
I'm moved by what Don said. I appreciate the passion they have and that they're willing to volunteer their time.
Yes.
And I want to give this a shot. It's just that, don't get me wrong.
Yes?
They look like high school kids.
Fred had his worries. First, he could see the attorneys were young and green, blowing off steam during breaks with Pac-Man and Nerf basketball. And second,
Don, I hope I don't sound ungracious, but I don't want to speak to any groups or such. It's just not something I'm good at. And is my name going to be in the papers? Are reporters going to be, you know, camping out on my lawn?
We'll do all the talking, Fred, and we'll protect you from the press. No sweat.
See, I work as a draftsman, and I'm not sure my firm would like it.
Dad, your ulcer. You should rest.
Yeah, Karen, I know. Thanks, Don.
Sure.
Look, Don, what I said, I'm sorry. Dad's been through a lot. We're protective of him.
Of course.
He paid a price for taking that stand. There were friends and family who shunned him when he did. Said he was a troublemaker and said he was making things worse. And all these years, he never said a word about his case.
When did he finally tell you?
He didn't. When I was a high school junior, my friend Maya gave a book report.
My report is about the wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans on the West Coast during World War II. I am going to be speaking about the Supreme Court case Korematsu versus the United States.
Korematsu? Did she just say...
In this case, the issue before the Supreme Court was whether the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans was, in fact, constitutional.
Oh, God. A couple of my classmates are looking at me.
And whether the government was justified in imprisoning tens of thousands of its own American citizens just because of their Japanese ancestry. The plaintiff, Fred Korematsu...
Fred Korematsu?
...lost his Supreme Court challenge, and his criminal conviction was never overturned. And so, his conviction remains on the books today.
Okay, this must be someone else. Dad would never break the law. He's just this quiet guy who... I mean, is it some distant relative? Some Korematsu black sheep no one's ever talked about? Because 35 pairs of eyes are staring at me.
Hey, Karen.
Hey, Maya. Great report.
Thanks. So, is that your dad? I mean, I didn't want to ask before, but...
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think so.
You mean, you don't know?
I turned around and hurried home feeling guilty that suddenly there might be this black mark on the family. When I got home... Dad was reading the paper and smoking his pipe.
Dad? Korematsu versus the United States. Is it you? Is it?
Yes.
Yes? That's it? That's all you're going to say?
I was going to tell you and Ken when you were old enough.
Old enough? Dad, I'm in high school now. You don't think that's old enough?
I wanted to tell you earlier, but...
Do you know how humiliated I felt? All my friends staring at me asking, is that your dad? And I couldn't even answer. Why haven't you ever told me?
I didn't want you growing up ashamed that your father was a criminal.
So, Don, that's how I found out. And after seeing the look on Dad's face when he walked out of the room, I never asked him about it again.
With Fred's blessing, we got to work. As lead counsel, Dale began rallying the troops.
Western Defense Commandos, listen up for assignments. Reviewing and organizing evidence. Peter and Lori, that's you.
Where did Don go?
Picking up pizza at Nikki D's.
Nah, the place with all the video games? Where I always crush you in Space Invaders?
No way.
5 pepperoni and mushroom, 5 six packs of bud.
Oh, yes.
What'd I miss?
Don, can you hit up our public education drive?
Sure.
As well as fundraising?
No sweat.
As well as press and media?
Which I know absolutely nothing about.
Don't worry, we'll get you up to speed.
And next Oakland A's game on me.
Ooh, who are they playing?
Red Sox.
Not the Yankees. Deal.
The A's are going down this year. Dodger blue all the way. We're taking the World Series.
No way.
In your dreams.
Lori, do you have something to pass out there?
A proposal for political strategy. How attacking these court cases can help advance our redress cause. Also, ideas on getting the story of the prison camps to the public.
Because not only do we have to win this case in a court of law, we've also got to win it in the court of public opinion.
And in the court of history.
Back in D.C., Iko was secretly feeding our document pipeline from the National Archives.
Dale, you called?
Iko, you all alone now?
Yeah, in a phone booth off manuscripts. Why?
I need supporting documents on Ringel's report. Paragraph 9.
Got it.
And I've got a very tough ask. The letter from J. Edgar Hoover to Attorney General Biddle dated June 7th. It's semi-classified. Think you can swing it?
Leave everything to me. I got Nick Chen and Phil Nash and a half dozen others on the hunt with me now.
Of course you do. Who wants to miss out on the action? Aren't you, and I quote, the nation's foremost expert on the available records on the camps?
No kidding. Who said that?
Your husband, Jack.
Aww.
Plus everyone we talk to.
What? I told you not to mention me. I'm a government employee here. I shouldn't be slipping you documents.
That incriminate your employer?
I've got my pension to think about.
Just kidding. Relax. We never mention your name to anyone. And you don't ever have to tell us if what you're doing is illegal. We really don't want to know.
Neither do I. But I got covered, Dale. The Freedom of Information Act.
Damn, girl. Should have known you'd think of everything. Oh, gotta run.
Tell Karen and Bob happy first anniversary. And say hi to all the young people.
You bet.
Okay, Iko. Your country needs you.
Hello, Agnes. How are you today? Oh, I just love that brooch you're wearing.
Iko was our ace in the hole. This sweet senior Nisei lady, charming and petite, who would ever suspect her? She was the perfect mole, the perfect ninja. Iko funneled us document upon document, demonstrating government misconduct at the highest level. As her work poured in from D.C., our team, now fortified with dozens of Bay Area lawyers, law students, and undergrads, saw something forming before our very eyes. An irrefutable history of the government's suppression of evidence before the Supreme Court. We planned to file Fred's petition in October 1982. But as the enormity of the work became clear, we pushed the date to December, and then again to January.
Last three items to discuss. First, money. We've almost exhausted all funds. Zero. Zip. Tap City. Don?
So far, we've spent $10,000.
And how much is left?
$500.
That's it? Where did it go?
Airfare costs, long-distance calls, DC research, office supplies, tons of bills for Xeroxing.
Noted. Second item, secrecy. Until we actually file. The stuff we've got locked up here could ruin reputations. And if someone gets wind of that and tries to destroy this evidence...
Then how do we raise money? The way to do that is to say we've got the goods on the government.
I'll form a group with a name that says just enough. The Committee to Reverse the Japanese-American Wartime Cases. Then we hit up every friend and family member to donate. That's Dennis with today's press.
Third, legal strategy. We've got to finalize.
I still say we aim straight for the top, right at the Supreme Court, where Fred lost in 44, where Justice Jackson called the ruling a loaded weapon for the future.
But there's no guarantee the court will even rule on the case. What if they dismiss it and we're left with no chance to appeal?
Yes, yes, it's a risk, but these convictions have got to be overruled. And if we succeed, bam, we're on the national evening news, the front page of the New York Times.
But we can't just file suit there. We'd have to appeal from a recent case, and ours is 40 years old.
Guys, we're sunk. Today's Pacific Citizen, Arthur Goldberg, he just threw us under the bus.
What? He's supposed to be on our side.
Arthur Goldberg. Former Supreme Court Justice, it is my considered opinion that it is not necessary and indeed not procedurally possible to mount a legal attack to overrule Korematsu.
Unbelievable!
Let me see that.
There's gotta be a mistake. Goldberg's been helping us push for reparations.
The Supreme Court of the United States has never, to my knowledge, reopened a decided case after such a lengthy interval. There is an obvious and strong public interest in finality of judgment.
Are you kidding me? What if it's a terrible judgment?
Indeed, any attempt to overturn Korematsu runs the danger of legitimizing this bad decision in the virtually certain event of denial by the court.
He's trying to shut us down before we've even filed.
Based on my experience as a Supreme Court justice, a coram nobis effort would be fruitless.
Fruitless? We've been working our asses off for months for something fruitless?
This doesn't make sense. Goldberg advises our community on legal strategy.
This will reach the public today, before we've even filed Fred's case.
He's trying to publicly torpedo us.
But why? What's his motive?
Hands off. That's his motive. Don't you dare attack the Supreme Court. And we can't let this matter.
But here's why it does matter. If a former Supreme Court justice who supports redress is saying this, what does it say about our chances for a win?
So don't even try? We have to. What happens when some crazy racist wants to get rid of someone else? And Korematsu's still on the books to justify that. Mass incarcerate citizens? Sure. The court says it's legal.
Oh, you think I don't know that? But...
Guys, it's the Supreme Court, the highest legal authority in the United States of America. These cases are some of the worst decisions in the court's history. Think of what it would mean if the court overruled its own mistake.
But would they even consider it? Finality of judgment. Goldberg says it right here. All legal battles have to end.
That's the thinking we have to ignore.
And that's what we can't ignore. The stakes are too high. We've been working our asses off to tell the story of what happened to our families. We've said that's just as important as the case itself. But a flaming loss at the Supreme Court means it's all over. People are already starting to say that if Fred loses a second time...
We're not going to lose.
It might resurrect the racism of the original ruling. It might hurt the redress movement, make us legal pariahs. We're young, we're green, we're Asian, we're unknown, and we're taking on a momentous case, accusing the U.S. government of fraud at the nation's highest court. We're attempting something that's never been done in American legal history. The whole country's going to be watching us.
The whole country should be watching us.
And if we fail at the Supreme Court, we're going to fail big. And here's the thing. I am absolutely 1,000% willing to risk it. I'm willing to go for broke on this case, no matter the outcome. Because we've got to get this evidence out there. This proof that the government screwed our families big time. But if we lose at the Supreme Court, who's going to listen to us? We've only got one shot at this.
Don, you're right, buddy. Let's think this through.
All right, guys. 2 points here. One, Goldberg's totally in the dark about the evidence we've got. But we know what we've got, and when the public knows, we're gonna knock their socks off. This is an open and shut case.
Nothing's open and shut, Lori.
And two, a Supreme Court challenge is not our only option. Guys, getting Korematsu overturned, I know that's what we've wanted from the first time Peter called us. But if we can't get it overturned, we can totally gut it. Show it's based on nothing but lies. And we can do that with our plan B.
The lower courts.
Yes.
Okay, team. We filed 3 cases in the lower courts where each case originated. We might not win them all. But this way, we'd have 3 chances to win instead of 1. 3 times at bat.
And if we lose, our case or cases could go to the 9th Circuit on a possible road back to the Supreme Court.
And this way, our cases have longer legs, which means we'll have more time to reach out to the public and more places to do it. And this is key. We know this tragedy can happen again if the public allows it to, or worse, wants it to. Now, granted, it's not as dazzling as hitting a home run at the Supreme Court.
We're not trying to be dazzling here. We're trying to get the country's eyes on this case.
And we also want to win. So I, for one, say, let's give ourselves the widest playing field.
Are we all agreed?
Yeah.
Okay, which case goes first? Who's got stats on judges?
Portland's got 3, Seattle 12, and San Francisco 20, with the highest number of liberals.
Hands down, it's San Francisco.
Wait, there's no guarantee we'll get a liberal judge here.
But we'll have the best odds, and we'll stagger the filings. If we get a good judge here, we'll wait a month to file the next case. Use that judge to put the pressure on the other two in Portland and Seattle. Agreed?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Batter up Fred.
Lori? Karen, what are you doing here so late?
Just stopping by to wish you luck. Big day tomorrow.
For us all. We're pulling one last all-nighter to polish everything up. What have you got there?
Mom thought you could use a snack.
A snack?
This is a feast. Oh, yakitori, potato salad, jello, sesame spinach.
And a big old tin of rice crackers from Yamashita's. Ta-da! Like our grandmothers used to bring us.
Oh, my bachan used to bring mine over Christmas morning. Oh, I love this kind of senbei with the nori wrapped around.
Mine too. Mm. I bet it's one of the things they miss most in the prison camps. Mm. Senbei and nori.
Oh, you gotta have nori.
Yeah.
Huh. My cousin once sat on a white Santa Claus's lap. And he said, would you like a candy cane, little girl? She said, can I have a can of nori instead? He said, nori? What the heck is that? She looked at him like he was an idiot. She said, it's dried seaweed. Ah, you should have seen the horrified look on his face.
Oh my God, that's rich.
How's Fred?
Well, all this excitement is a little tough. His ulcers, he just got out of the hospital for treatments. But he appreciates all the sacrifices you're all making on his behalf.
He's sacrificed so much more. All these years, all of you have.
Thanks. And Lori?
Yes?
Mom and I, we're overjoyed that this team is so many women. Mom told me in her time she didn't know any women that went to law school. Is it ever hard for you to be taken seriously?
Oh, hell yeah. Just last week in court. God, I heard it again. Miss, are you the interpreter? Where is the attorney? I'm the attorney, I said. And I get that double take. So, I tell myself, the legal profession holds the keys to justice. And getting those keys in our hands, it's going to be worth it all.
No matter how many years it takes.
We're gonna prove the doubters wrong, Karen. They're not gonna know what hit them.
So you and the rest of the team, you all feel this is worth it? Dad worries that if he loses again...
I know if we don't do this, we'll regret it for the rest of our lives. Win or lose, we're going to tell Fred's story.
Good luck, Lori.
Good luck, Karen.
On the morning of January 31st, Dale, Don, Lori, and I drove over the Bay Bridge from Oakland to file Fred's petition, along with a thick stack of exhibits. All of us were on edge. The kind of judge we'd draw this morning could determine the kind of justice we'd get.
Lori, you okay back there?
The stack of papers is 3 feet high. I can hardly see over them.
Careful, they're all in order.
Dale, look out.
Oh!
Oh, man. Will you look at that line at the toll plaza? What the hell is going on? This always happens to me. I get in the shortest line.
And it ends up taking the longest. Happens to me every time. I've always been unlucky.
You want to hear unlucky? I've never even won a sack of rice at the Oakland Methodist raffle.
And man, that really sucks. Because we're at the mercy of luck today in the assignment of our judge. So, should three guys who have always been unlucky be the ones to file such a monumental...
Lori.
Lori.
Huh?
Lori, you do the filing.
Me?
Of the four of us, you're the luckiest.
You guys can't be serious.
Oh, we are. The fate of our case is resting on you.
Lori, don't screw this up. Barinsky's a total washout. If she draws Barinsky, we're toast.
Sutton. Forget Sutton. We're sunk if she gets Sutton.
Girl, you can do this.
Knock it out of the park.
You got this.
Go for it!
Hello, ma'am. I'm Lorraine Bunai. I'm here to file a petition against the United States government.
Okay. This filing is highly unusual, to say the least. A petition for writ of error coram nobis? I've never actually seen one of these before. It's quite obscure, very rarely used.
Yes.
The name of the judge who convicted Mr. Korematsu is Judge Adolphus St. Shore, but he's been dead for 35 years?
Yes.
And Mr. Korematsu's Supreme Court case has been closed for 40 years?
Yes.
You're sure you want to do this?
Absolutely.
Okay. Don't say I didn't warn you. We gotta assign your judge now, so let's give her a whirl. You got Judge Patel.
Judge Patel?
Judge Marilyn Patel.
Are you sure?
Says right here.
Could you double check that, please?
It's correct. P-A-T-E-L. You want me to print the ticket out for you?
No, nope. That won't be necessary. Thank you.
Sure. Good luck with that Coram Nobis case. Unfortunately, I think you're going to need it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Oh my god! We got Judge Patel!
Way to go, Lori!
Yes! Told you you'd be good luck!
Oh my god!
She's one of the best judges you could have drawn! She's worked for the National Organization for Women.
She was appointed by Jimmy Carter!
She's a supporter of civil liberties, her husband's East Indian, she's got experience with ethnic minorities!
Judge Marilyn Patel, we hoped, would understand the injustice brought upon Fred and the rest of the Japanese-American community during World War II. On the day we filed, Don called a press conference to announce the reopening of Fred's historic case.
Low expectations, okay, guys? Because I don't know if any of the press is even going to show up.
What the hell? You said you had the networks on the hook.
Yeah, I did. I played them against each other, told ABC and NBC that CBS was following the story, made them think it meant that CBS was actually coming, and it worked. CBS will be there? Okay, we'll be there too. But in my follow-up, man, I lost them. This Japanese-American prison thing, you're saying that happened here? You sure this isn't about Japanese prisoners of war?
Everyone ready? Okay, here we go.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York. You're listening to For Us All by Jeannie Sakata on WBAI Playhouse, produced by LA Theater Works.
And now, Hour 2 of For Us All by Jeannie Sakata, directed by Annalise Erickson.
You guys!
Holy cow, look at them!
New York Times, LA Times, Baltimore Sun, San Francisco Examiner.
And all the networks. Yes!
Dale, you're on. And Dale?
Yeah?
Don't screw this up.
Welcome, everyone. Would everyone please have a seat? Today we are filing these petitions for writ of error coram nobis to reopen cases which upheld the convictions of Minoru Yasui, Gordon Hirabayashi, and Fred Korematsu, and validated the forced removal and curfew orders which led to the imprisonment of 115,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. The basis of our petitions is recently discovered evidence that indicates that high government officials suppressed, altered, and destroyed evidence in order to influence the outcomes of these cases at trial and on appeal, including appeals to the United States Supreme Court. Don?
We have here a unique opportunity to correct a wrong, where there was a gross violation of the civil liberties of Japanese Americans and an enormous toll of human suffering. What we are asking here is not just for sympathy. We are asking for something very simple, and that is the justice that was denied these men 40 years ago. And now, let's hear from Fred Korematsu.
I was born here in Oakland, here in the Bay Area. And I went to school here and learned all about the Constitution. I'm just like every other American. I wanted to stay here. And when this evacuation came, I felt I was not a criminal or enemy alien, which I was classified as. And at the time of the evacuation, I stayed. I probably would assume that you, as American citizens, had they told you to get out, you'd feel the same way.
Are there any questions? Yes.
You're seeking to reopen cases decided by the Supreme Court in the 1940s?
We are.
And you are doing that through an obscure legal process called what?
Coram nobis, a very rarely used proceeding that can be used to attack a criminal conviction.
Are you all serious?
Dead serious.
Today, news of the scandal of the World War II government cover-up in the Supreme Court cases of three American citizens, Fred Korematsu, Minoru Yasui, and Gordon Hirabayashi. There is a shocking claim that then-Solicitor General Charles Fahey had lied to the Supreme Court during these Americans' trials about his claim that military necessity drove its decision to mass incarcerate over 100,000 people of Japanese ancestry. According to the litigators, newly surfaced evidence will show the motives for this decision were purely racist in nature. I'm sitting here with World War II Justice Department lawyer Edward Ennis. Mr. Ennis, what do you have to say about the trial which opened today in San Francisco?
Well, I am still adamant in my view that the wartime incarceration and evacuation of Japanese Americans was 100% wrong. However, the case faces serious hurdles.
Do you believe the three men in question have a chance of getting the court's decisions overturned?
Well, they must prove that manifest injustice took place. And that means that the government knowingly lied to the Supreme Court 40 years ago, not just that military reports were factually incorrect.
In the 1940s, Mr. Ennis, you authored a memo stating that lies were being told to the Supreme Court. Do you stand by that claim?
I do.
And yet, Mr. Ennis, are you aware that Lyle Denniston of the Baltimore Sun, who has reported on the Supreme Court since 1958, said to date that this campaign is a legal long shot? What is your response?
Well, I wish with all my heart I did not have to agree with that. But I do. For Mr. Korematsu, this will be an uphill battle.
Fred was not well, and after the presser, we took him straight home. Right after Christmas, he had gone to the hospital with bleeding ulcers. On New Year's Day, he had surgery to remove a third of his stomach. Now he rested at home, watching the TV coverage.
For Mr. Korematsu, this will be an uphill battle.
An uphill battle? That's what the press is saying? Then I'm going to help you.
What's that, Fred?
When the team goes out to raise money again, this time, I'm going to help you.
Fred, no, you can't possibly...
You young people are putting your careers on the line for me. It's the least I can do. Besides, I have more time now. They let me go at work.
What? How did they...
Yeah, the press coverage. They've been seeing it, and they've been asking me, why are you doing this, Fred? Now, look, I haven't mentioned it because I didn't want you to worry. I can freelance now while I'm helping the team.
But we promised you wouldn't have to.
So, I guess you were lying. Where's my first stop?
Fred started small and local in the Bay Area, churches and community groups. Then on to Sacramento and south to Los Angeles. Soon he was traveling across the country, our emissary to the American public. And as we watched him, shaking hands, working the crowds, being interviewed on TV's 60 Minutes, we knew we had created a monster. The government responded to our petition in March, making it clear they'd delay the trial proceedings as long as possible. Victor Stone, counsel for the U.S. Justice Department, insisted over and over that he needed more time to digest our evidence, to consult with the government, to wait for the CWRIC's recommendations, and to deal with the probability our charges might upset some people.
I'm here today with John J. McCloy, Assistant Secretary of War during World War II. Mr. McCloy, let me first congratulate you. Last month, Harper's Magazine called you the most influential private citizen in America.
Well, thank you, Sean. Well,
to be immodest, but since the war, I've also advised 9 presidents, chaired the board of Chase Manhattan Bank.
How do you feel about the issue of Japanese-American redress and the allegations of government misconduct in the Korematsu case?
I'm warning every one of those leaders today that if we bow to this Japanese-American lobby pressing for redress, we will perpetuate injustice. The consensus of prudent, responsible officials at the time, without rebuttal from any quarter, was that an attack was possible, accompanied with sabotage by the ethnic Japanese.
But the Korematsu team claims they have evidence from the responsible intelligence agencies that does rebut the witness claims of Japanese-American espionage and sabotage.
The Japanese threat was heavily concentrated along the West Coast defense installations. It simply was not feasible to carry out immediate personal evacuation of 120,000 Japanese-Americans and resident aliens.
Are you suggesting, Mr. McCloy, that DeWitt ordered this mass incarceration based on a lack of time? The Korematsu team says there is overwhelming evidence to the contrary.
I am saying, young man, that I am outraged that these people think they can attack the integrity of senior wartime government officials. To associate ignorant prejudice with such honorable men is an affront to their memory and the total misconception of the facts.
Fred, we just got word. It's all over the press. The CWRIC announced its recommendations. They're saying Congress should issue a national apology for the camps.
That's good. That's very good.
And approve redress payments. $20,000 for every survivor.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear the commission telling Congress to do the right thing.
But they're also saying that...
Yes?
That the president should pardon those who violated military orders.
A pardon?
And Fred, this recommendation was made over our objections, but...
A pardon? So, that would mean that I committed a crime and was being forgiven for it?
Yes, that's correct.
And if I accepted this pardon, could I still pursue this case?
No. We'd have to drop it.
Then, no. It's not acceptable.
Fred, if you want to think it over...
That won't be necessary.
We just want you to be sure.
I'm sure. I'm very sure. If anything, we should be pardoning the government.
Mr. Manami? Victor Stone, counsel for the defense.
Let me guess... You want more time.
I am in an unbelievable position. Given the new recommendation for a presidential pardon that has just come from the CWRIC, the government would like a further extension of time to consider our options.
Mr. Stone, our 3 petitioners want a judicial vacation of their convictions and a hearing on our allegations as soon as possible.
Well, I wish to propose something you may want to consider. How about... A pardon for innocence.
A pardon for innocence? What the hell is that?
A pardon which would acknowledge that the person pardoned is actually innocent of the charges.
If the person pardoned is innocent of the charges, why would he need to be pardoned?
Well, you see...
We reject the pardon for innocence, Mr. Stone. You can't play this game forever.
On October 4th, 1983, Stone filed the government's response.
Your Honor, in 1942, the petitioner was one of the few standard bearers who chose to challenge the propriety of Executive Order 9066. Now, the mass removal of Japanese Americans from the West Coast was part of an unfortunate episode in our nation's history. But surely this tragedy has now been adequately acknowledged in President Gerald Ford's proclamation of February 19, 1976, which not only formally terminated Executive Order 9066, but also issued a sincere apology. President Ford wrote, "We now know what we should have known then. Not only was the evacuation wrong, but Japanese Americans were and are loyal Americans. On the battlefield and at home, the names of Japanese Americans have been and continue to be written in history for the sacrifices and contributions they have made to the nation." Now, given that the United States government has acknowledged that the wartime treatment of Japanese Americans was wrong, and because we believe that it is time to put behind us the controversy which led to this tragedy, we conclude it is appropriate to vacate this conviction. It is not our intent to keep harassing Mr. Korematsu. If what he wants is getting his conviction vacated, that is what he can have. However, it is not necessary for the court to address the claims of government fraud. Therefore, I move to dismiss not only the original 1942 indictment filed against Mr. Korematsu, but also his Coram Nobis petition and its allegations of governmental misconduct.
Order! Order!
We are here outside the courthouse awaiting Fred Korematsu's response as he weighs the government's proposal. Mark, as political analyst for the Times, what are your thoughts?
Liz, in these past few weeks, Mr. Korematsu has become a hero to many Americans. He's brought attention to the injustice of World War II and the suffering of his fellow citizens. And for that, we should all be grateful.
Should he accept the government's offer, Mark?
Yes, I think so. The CWRIC has said it all. No completely satisfactory answer can be reached about these emotion-laden issues. And so, for the sake of unity and healing, for the good of the country, I hope Mr. Korematsu can put this tragedy behind him now and move on with his life.
Here's where we are, Fred. On the one hand, we're on the brink of achieving what you've sought for 40 years, the clearing of your name. In that respect,
I would win.
Yes. However, in offering to vacate your conviction, the government would not be admitting its lies in arguing at the Supreme Court that the forced removal of our families was due to military necessity.
But all the work the team has done.
Fred, this moment isn't about us. It's about you. You've lived 40 years with this ruling and all its consequences, and we're here to support you in whatever you wish to do. But we need your decision now.
Okay. Here it is. It's not enough. Vacating my conviction. It's not enough. This fight isn't just for me. Let's hold the government accountable.
November 10th, 1983. At last, Fred's day in court arrived. Across the country, numerous civic, legal, and religious organizations had filed amicus briefs in support of Fred, all aware his case could have effects far beyond the reversal of his own conviction. Over 500 spectators packed the chamber, among them elderly Japanese Americans who had weathered years of imprisonment behind barbed wire, crying out now to campmates they had not seen for 40 years. As television and film crews flooded the hallway, Fred, his family, and our legal team entered the courtroom, Fred's wife, Catherine, stopping just long enough to smooth his hair. Finally, Judge Patel took the bench.
Mr. Stone, first things first. I'm sorry to say I do not consider the government's motion to vacate the conviction and dismiss the petition as a proper vehicle for judicial action.
That is unfortunate, Your Honor.
It is unfortunate, Mr. Stone, that you have wasted months of the people's time. Now, Mr. Minami, your oral argument?
Your Honor,
We are here today to seek a measure of the justice denied to Fred Korematsu and the Japanese American community 40 years ago. The allegations we put forth are perhaps unique in legal history, that high government officials suppressed, altered, and destroyed information and evidence in order to influence the outcome of a Supreme Court case. No doubt these officials assumed their shocking betrayal of our democratic process would remain a secret throughout the course of history. But fortunately, that is not the case, because that evidence has been recovered and presented to the court, a few key pieces of which we highlight today. Your Honor, I hold before you a memo from Edward Ennis, an attorney with the United States Justice Department in 1943. In this memo to Solicitor General Charles Fahey, Ennis expresses his alarm and distress that the United States government is presenting lies to the court in a War Department document written by General John DeWitt, titled The Final Report. What are DeWitt's lies? First, that Japanese Americans are committing acts of espionage and sabotage and are, as a race, prone to disloyalty. Second, that their mass incarceration is therefore key to national security. And third, that because the Army lacks time for individual trials of suspects, that incarceration must happen immediately as a military necessity. Now, how do we know these statements are false? Because of the vast body of evidence we've already submitted to the court, numerous statements and reports from all three government intelligence agencies directly refuting DeWitt's claims of Japanese-American disloyalty, and all of which were deliberately suppressed at Mr. Korematsu's Supreme Court trial. In addition, let us turn our attention to another key piece of evidence. Edward Ennis knew that DeWitt's claims of military necessity for a rushed policy of mass incarceration were false, because the report in which DeWitt made these claims was actually an altered version of his original report, which I present to you now. In this original, DeWitt makes two key declarations. One, that there is, in fact, sufficient time for individual trials of suspects. And two, that it is of no matter, because it is impossible to determine the loyalty of Japanese Americans, no matter how much time is available. Your Honor, we've submitted to you War Department correspondence confirming this conspiracy to destroy the original report and replace it with a doctored version. And in addition, we share with you now DeWitt's exact words from a phone call made in 1943 to Provost Marshal General Allen Gullion. I don't see how they can determine the loyalty of a Jap by investigation. There isn't such a thing as a loyal Japanese. Your Honor, Fred Korematsu lived 40 years with a criminal conviction infected with error, while carrying the burden of losing the case which sanctioned the mass imprisonment of his people. He fought virtually alone, when his community was either too young, too tired, too old, or too frightened to fight alongside him. He fought against a monumental tragedy, the mass banishment of a single racial minority group, in which the total in lost property, lost opportunities, broken families, and human suffering was staggering. Today, the government is arguing that we should put the controversy behind us, that we should let old wounds heal. But whose wounds need healing? The Japanese Americans who have lived with the stigma of this decision for 40 years? For those Japanese American internees, for Fred Korematsu, and for this court. This is the last opportunity to finally achieve the justice denied 40 years ago. Thank you, Your Honor. And now I request that Fred Korematsu be allowed to address the court.
A very unusual request. But today, I'll allow it. Mr. Korematsu.
Your Honor, I still remember 40 years ago when I was handcuffed and arrested as a criminal here in San Francisco. And speaking today for all those who've endured the concentration camps, I ask for vindication, not just for myself, but for those who suffered with me. As long as my record stands in federal court, any American citizen can be held in prison or concentration camps without a trial or hearing. I would like to see the government admit that they were wrong and do something about it so this will never happen again to any American citizen of any race, creed, or color.
Thank you, Mr. Korematsu. Mr. Stone, your response?
Acknowledgement of this tragedy as a national mistake justifies vacating the conviction and dismissing this petition.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. I'd like to acknowledge all of you who took the time to attend today. When I was informed how many of you would likely be here, I changed the location of this trial to this courtroom with 500 seats. And still, we've had to bring in extra chairs here in the aisles. You came for personal reasons. And you deserve a response from this court, not months from now, but today. Therefore, I will make my ruling from the bench. I have carefully considered, Mr. Minami, the documents you have presented, as well as the report of the Commission on Wartime Relocation, as grounds for my decision today, which is that the government's petition response is tantamount to a confession of error, and that a coram nobis petition is indeed the appropriate vehicle for the court to correct fundamental errors in its record. To all of you here today, I must remind you of the limited scope of my authority as a district judge. Regrettably, I cannot reverse the Supreme Court opinion of 1944, nor can I correct any errors of law that justices may have made. Thus, Korematsu remains on the pages of our legal and political history. As historical precedent, it stands as a constant caution that in times of war or declared military necessity, our institutions must be vigilant in protecting constitutional guarantees. That the shield of military necessity must not be used to protect governmental actions from close scrutiny and accountability. That in times of international hostility, our institutions, legislative, executive, and judicial, must protect all citizens from the fears and prejudices that are so easily aroused. And so, today, Mr. Korematsu's petition for a writ of coram nobis is granted.
The abrupt end of the hearing left us all in complete silence. And then, a lone voice rang out across the courtroom.
Fred! You won! Oh, my God, I can't believe it! Oh, Dad! We did it! We did it!
What just happened?
You won, Fred! You won!
I did?
Yes!
Oh. That's good. That's really good.
Fred, you did it.
Your victory is for us all. For us all, Fred.
Thank you for your help, Aiko.
No, it was the young people here. It was the young people.
Aiko, that's not true.
Peter, we did it.
You sure did, Aiko. We were a good team.
We were a brilliant team. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Aiko?
Too late. We lost her.
I can't keep up with her. Never could.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
What's with Fred?
He doesn't get that he won yet. Don't think he can grasp it.
I guess after 40 years. Nice work, Dale.
Nice work, Don and Lori. Not bad for two kids from Gardena and one homie from Oakland.
Not bad at all. Hey, Don, your folks?
They're right over there, being interviewed.
Boasting how proud they are of their lawyer son?
Nah. They're talking about the evidence. It's all they ever talk about, ever since I showed it all to them. After all those years of silence, the floodgates opened up and...
I'll take it from here. Just one last question, Dale.
Shoot.
What's our next pro bono case?
Mr. Korematsu! And Mr. Korematsu over here! Mr. Korematsu, my sincere congratulations on your victory. But why did you wait 40 years to seek your vindication?
I had to do some real deep thinking in order to reopen this case again. I am very happy I did, because this is important, not only for Japanese Americans, but for all Americans.
Do you feel differently now than you felt in 1942?
I don't feel so alone. I just wish my mother and father could have known that I won, thanks to a very special team with many young sensei. Who else would have taken on this case but a bunch of crazy young people?
And on that happy note, back to you in the studio.
On the day Fred won, I was flooded with emotion. I wasn't sure I could even speak to the press or anybody else. I felt overjoyed. I stood back looking at this audience, almost all Japanese American, seeing how much this affected them. And more than ever before in my life, I felt I'd been included in a group that was not my own. People I might not otherwise have ever met or gotten to know, they'd invited me in and included me. This was a once-in-a-lifetime case. There would never be another one like it. And as we all said goodbye and returned to our lives, we knew we'd never forget this historic battle we'd been privileged to be a part of. But Fred's case didn't end there. At least not in the consciousness of many across the country, who for years to come asked to hear about three Americans who stood up for their constitutional rights in a hostile and dangerous time.
Min Yasui's case was heard by Judge Baloney in 1984 in Portland. The judge vacated Min's conviction, but refused his quorum nobis petition, declaring, "I do not wish to engage in making findings on an event 40 years post facto, that I feel have no legal consequences."
Peggy Nagai and the Portland team appealed the ruling, but 2 years later, Min died in November 1986 before a decision on his appeal was reached.
Gordon Hirabayashi's case was heard by Judge Voorhees in May 1984. Catherine Banai led Gordon's team, and later, Rod Kawakami. Judge Voorhees granted the writ of coram nobis for the exclusion charge. A federal appellate court, led by Judge Mary Schroeder, granted it for the curfew charge, and Gordon cleared his name.
The three men joined us in telling their stories across the country, becoming civil rights advocates for those whose constitutional rights were being violated, as theirs had been.
In 1998, Fred received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Clinton, and in later years, posthumously, Gordon and Min received the same honors from President Obama. Fred continued his advocacy till he passed away in 2005, honored and commemorated across the country.
But the case that bore his name continued to be debated. Though we had thoroughly exposed the fraudulent basis of Fred's conviction, it remained on the Supreme Court books for two dangerous propositions.
One, the government can uproot, banish and imprison an entire ethnic group for indefinite confinement without due process.
And two, that the Supreme Court can cede complete deference to the president even when constitutional rights are at stake.
In 2016, presidential frontrunner Donald Trump told Time magazine he didn't know if he would have opposed the World War II imprisonment of Japanese Americans, stating, "War is tough."
In January 2017, with Trump in the White House, rumors swirled of a government registry of immigrants from Muslim-majority countries, while a super PAC chair cited the idea's precedent. We did it during World War II with the Japanese.
On June 26, 2019, the Supreme Court upheld Trump's ban on travel from several predominantly Muslim countries while simultaneously repudiating its 1944 Korematsu ruling.
Karen Korematsu fired back in response. On the day the court finally claims to overrule Korematsu, they vilified another racial group in the very same ruling, replacing one injustice with another.
Soon after, the Trump administration announced its plan to use Fort Sill, Oklahoma, the site of a World War II Japanese-American prison camp, to detain over 1,400 migrant children. Japanese-American camp survivors marched and chanted in protest,
"Stop repeating history!"
In pivotal times like ours, who can change the course of history?
Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And battling under that arc, a few, like King, are extraordinary visionaries who glimpse the mountaintop."
But many are like Fred, a most unlikely hero, who shunned the limelight until a tiny crack of light that broke his world in two. Millions of ordinary people.
A husband. A father.
A devoted daughter.
A housewife. A church secretary.
A civil rights attorney with a rundown Xerox machine.
A 25-year-old attorney, 1 year out of law school.
A draft resistor who stumbled by accident on an obscure legal procedure.
A community volunteer with a sawhorse and doorboard desk.
Ordinary people fighting to do ordinary things.
Go to school.
Go to work.
Stay in our homes.
Vote.
Marry whom we love.
Raise children.
Worship at church.
Ride a bus on any seat.
Be protected by law enforcement.
Be cared for when we're sick.
Ordinary people with extraordinary challenges before us.
Will we rise to meet them?
Will we write a new history?
It's up to each of us.
And it is for us all.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York. You're listening to For Us All by Jeannie Sakata on WBAI Playhouse, produced by LA Theater Works.
Conversation with some of the actual lawyers and advocates who inspired the play.
Hello, everyone. I'm Susan Lowenberg, producing director of LA Theater Works. The 40-year saga of three Japanese Americans who challenged the incarceration of over 100,000 of their fellow citizens is a powerful, heart-wrenching story captured beautifully in Jeannie Sakata's play, For Us All, which focuses on the Coram Nobis case of Fred Korematsu. Jeannie's story is especially poignant given the atmosphere in America in 2021, which has seen an alarming rise in racist language and violence toward Asian Americans. The battle for social justice is hardly over. That's why we're glad to have a distinguished panel joining us today to talk about the events in For Us All, including playwright Jeannie Sakata and key members of the team who worked on the landmark cases in the 1980s. Peter?
I'm Peter Irons. I'm a retired constitutional law professor at the University of California in San Diego. And I started working on a book about the internment cases back in 1981. We're still not done, of course. This goes on, and educating new generations is very, very important. Right now, I've just finished a book. It's called White Men's Law, The Roots of Systemic Racism.
I'm Dale Minami. I'm a senior counsel at the Minami Tamaki LLP, a law firm in San Francisco. I was the lead counsel for Fred Korematsu with a team of about 10 attorneys, which reopened his case based on the research from Peter and also Aiko Yoshinaga Herzig. Now I've been spending most of my time with the project that started with Don Tamaki called Stop Repeating History, and trying to draw the parallels between past events and current situation, which is deplorable given the amount of anti-Asian hate crimes and violence that we see every day.
Lori?
I'm Lori Bonai. I teach at Seattle University School of Law, where I work with the Fred T. Korematsu Center for Law and Equality. So it's a real privilege and honor to continue to be working in Fred's name, doing civil rights litigation all over the country now. As Dale mentioned, a number of us who worked on Fred's case in the 1980s are still working together all these years later in this campaign, Stop Repeating History. I just come out with a co-authored book called Race, Rights, and National Security, Law and the Japanese-American Incarceration.
Thank you. Don?
Hello, I'm Don Tamaki. My day job is senior counsel at Minami Tamaki LLP. And because, as Lori has said, the relevance of Korematsu, regrettably, is probably more pertinent and more relevant today than it was when we reopened Fred's case in the 1980s. We promised Fred, actually, when we started this case, that win or lose, we would educate the American public about the perils to democracy when systemic racism and alternative facts replace the real ones that in 1942 resulted in a civil liberties disaster. Unfortunately, a lot of those themes are continuing to repeat themselves. So we've launched a public awareness campaign to remind the public and the courts and our democratic institutions that we must be ever vigilant against history repeating itself.
Thank you, Don. Jeannie?
Hi, I'm Jeannie Sakata. I'm an actor and a playwright. I started out as an actor at East West Players here in Los Angeles in Little Tokyo, first Asian American theater company. And my life was actually changed by a play I saw, a Japanese American playwright, Anise Wakako Yamauchi, who wrote a play called And the Soul Shall Dance. And I actually did not know at the time, you know, I was a young student at UCLA, and I didn't even know there were plays about Japanese American farming families like the one I had come from. So this play changed my life. And I started out as an actor at East West Players. And I continued on with that until the 1990s, when I learned about an amazing man named Gordon Hirabayashi, a Nisei man of my father's generation, who openly defied and legally challenged racist curfew and Executive Order 9066, the government orders that were issued for Japanese Americans on the West Coast to be forcibly removed from their homes and put into prison camps in the desert. And I had not known of Gordon's story. I'd never really heard the details of it, and I was fascinated by it and riveted. And it drove me to do all the research that I could about Gordon and to meet him and interview him. And that led to the writing of a solo show called Hold These Truths, which has been touring the country for the past 13 years. We've been very blessed in how much interest there's been in this play. And there would be a couple productions actually coming up this year. And that also led to LA Theater Works recording that play. And happily, they commissioned me, you commissioned me, to write this new play for us all, which is about the Coram Novus battle of Fred Korematsu and the attorneys here with us today that led that battle. So I am now also a playwright, and I'm trying to juggle these two careers. And it's a real blessing to be able to have two avenues of self-expression as an Asian American artist.
Jeannie, you're balancing beautifully, I must say.
Oh, thank you. It's a challenge, but thank you.
Before we get started with our panelists, though, I'd like to know, what were the particular challenges that you faced in writing For Us All and Hold These Truths, which we recorded in 2019.
Yes. Well, both of these stories were of great historical significance in the history of American civil rights. But in a very personal level for me, they filled in, I think, a part of my psyche where there was a great gap, a great hole, because my family never talked about their experiences with the camps. The challenges of both of these stories were that they were big, complex, multifaceted stories with a great variety and number of characters and incidents. And it was a challenge to distill all of this complexity down into the requirements of a good dramatic play, which has the requirements of, for example, characters that each have to have an arc and a path of growth in the play, and there has to be dramatic tension, the heart of drama is conflict, so there has to be sustained conflict from each scene in the play flowing into the next. Each scene has to have a beginning, middle, and end. The play has to start off with the powerful moment, build to a climax, and in between, there's got to be a balance of tension and drama with humor, because humor is a great tool to, keep the audience connected to your story. So with both of these plays, I love the term history play, which I actually got from an interview with David Hare, who wrote a play called Stuff Happens, about the Iraq War and the Bush administration and all the characters that were involved in discussions and implementation of policy about that. And a history play to me means that it's a blend, hopefully an artful blend, of fact and fiction. All four of these attorneys told me such wonderful stories. There was just a plethora. And, you could only include a fraction because of the time limit. But this should really be a mini-series. Gordon's story and the story of Fred Skornova's battle, they should both be mini-series, in my opinion. So
Jeannie, do you want to take over now for me and interview our panelists?
Yes, that would be my honor. And thank you again, Dale, Don, Lori, and Peter for joining us today. It's a real honor to ask you these questions. Peter, I am going to start with you. For Us All opens with that very powerful moment in DC when you first open the box that's been untouched for 40 years, covered with dust. It's labeled Korematsu versus the United States. And you look at the very first document line on top. Now, you told me you were stunned by that document and the rest of the contents of the box. Can you tell us why that was and why you immediately called Aiko Hirotsugi Yoshinaga after you examined the contents of that box?
Well, this is a fascinating story because it really, although it's factual, you really couldn't make this kind of stuff up. So many things happened that were total coincidences. You couldn't have foreseen them leading us to where we are right now. But back in 1981, I decided to write a book about the Supreme Court cases of Gordon, Fred, and Min. I had never met a Japanese-American person before that. And in my constitutional law class at Harvard Law School, Professor Larry Tribe, who most people know about, was discussing these cases and making it clear, just from the excerpts that we read in the casebook, how horrible this decision was. And so I decided to look at how the court handled these cases, because at the time, in 1943 and 1944, the members of the Supreme Court were probably the most liberal that we've had in our history. People like Felix Frankfurter, William O. Douglas, Frank Murphy, Hugo Black, Harlan Stone. These were, great justices. But particularly in Gordon's case, the first that came up, they made a terrible decision. They based it really on racist stereotypes that had been given to them by the government's lawyers in their briefs and arguments. And when I got to working on the case, and as Don said, you know, this was the case of a lifetime. All of us, Lori, Don, Dale, and everybody else who worked on this, knows that this was the most important case they were likely to ever handle. And so that's how we got started. And there's, of course, a lot of stories about getting together for the first time with the lawyers in San Francisco, going over to Fred's house and having a meeting with him. Fred actually thought these were all like high school kids because they were so young at the time. I was the oldest of them in my early 40s.
Thank you so much. And that actually leads right into my next question, which is for you, Don Tamaki. Thank you for joining us. So my question for you, Don, is in addition to preparing for Fred's court battle, you attorneys felt it was of equal importance to use the case to educate the American public about the World War II Japanese-American camp experience. Now, you were in charge of this public education campaign for which you said there were three goals. Can you share with us what those goals were?
Thank you. I think even before I talk about that, I do want to express our heartfelt gratitude to Peter Irons and Aiko Yoshinaga Herzig. I think the public owes them a great debt, but the legal team, everybody who participated in this case, it did change our lives. And the reason why it did change our lives is because we were so personally connected to the whole thing. It was our families who were incarcerated. It was our families who were so traumatized that they never discussed their experience. You know, after the camps closed, people returned to the very communities that exiled them in the first place. And the lesson was anything connected with being Japanese and your culture and your language should be abandoned. And you should become as white as you can, as fast as you can, and keep a low profile. Keep your mouth shut. And so an entire generation of people didn't talk about this to the great loss to the American history and the public. And it was really Peter and Aiko that by accident found these documents after 37 years. And it was Peter who knew the significance of them. Having done his own Coram Nobis case, he found a vehicle that was not subject to any statute of limitations. There were really three purposes. One was to impair, discredit, undermine, overrule this landmark case, Korematsu versus the United States, because it was bad then in 1942. It's a horrible precedent continuing forward. Justice Jackson wrote in his dissent, you know, the case lies around like a loaded weapon, ready from the hand of any authority who could put forth a plausible claim of an urgent need, meaning without trial, without evidence, without any due process, an entire racial group could be rounded up and imprisoned and made to lose their property and their freedom and for some even their lives with no legal recourse. So that is a very dangerous precedent. The second thing, however, was to educate the American public about what happened. And this is what so important about what Peter and Aiko found. But what began as wartime hysteria, people being scared, ultimately ended up at the highest echelons of our legal system as a calculated plan to uphold the validity of this rounding up of Americans without trial and for no offense, even if it meant lying to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Now that revealed it wasn't a mistake. It wasn't a tragedy. It wasn't just a bad decision. It was a scandal of epic proportions. It represented the undermining of the whole judicial system, and the victims of that whole process were Japanese Americans, and the precedent was set so it left the door open for future victims of any other marginalized group. So we had to do whatever we could to educate the public, and we promised Fred, win or lose, we were going to, it was our mission for as long as we were alive to basically inform the public of what happened. So we're very grateful. And I'm glad personally that we kept our promise to Fred. The third thing was to vindicate our families. So, you know, as you know, this was a very personal thing for all of us. And as our parents and our families really never talked about it because we were so traumatized about it, the play, you know, depicts Fred Cormazzo not even telling his daughter, Karen, about what he had went through, that he was the subject of a landmark U.S. Supreme Court case, and that he lost. And so the fact that we could vindicate our families who basically kind of lived in shame as if they had done something wrong, and so they never talked about it. And it's no wonder that they felt that way. I mean, the case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. He lost. I think people concluded that if the court rules against you, you must have been guilty of something. Disloyalty, espionage, you're something less than being American. You are a foreigner, basically. So it was very important from our own vindication of our families that we set that out. And by doing so, I think we taught the country a lesson, and we continue to do so. I think Fred's case is a textbook lesson on the meaning of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can't take your civil liberties for granted.
Well, Dale, you attorneys were strategizing and preparing for the Korematsu, Yasu, and Hirabayashi cases. At the same time, there was a movement and campaign for Japanese-American redress happening for monetary reparations and a government apology. What, if any, was the relationship between the redress movement and these three cases?
Well, the redress movement started in the early 70s, and resolutions were passed, legislation was passed, but it actually lost steam and didn't go anywhere till probably the late 70s. And so our cases arose in 1981 and 82 when Peter found the evidence. And it was right in the midst of a battle by the Japanese American community and their allies of all colors to try to get legislation to get the government to apologize and issue redress payments of $20,000, as well as an educational fund in redress for what happened to Japanese Americans. The problem in Congress was that the opponents of redress were arguing that the Supreme Court had already ruled on these in Korematsu, Hirabayashi, and Yasui, so that what was done to Japanese Americans was validated by the highest court of our land. Part of our other purpose in winning these cases was to get a judicial declaration. We needed an antidote. We needed a counter to the arguments made by opponents in Congress that what was done to Japanese Americans was both legal and moral. I mean, you could argue that it was not moral, clearly, because the constitutional rights were all ignored and neglected. But what we wanted is a finding of fact that there was racism that fueled the incarceration and the decisions that were made, that the Japanese Americans were not guilty of espionage or sabotage, as was argued in the Supreme Court with the evidence that was discovered, and that Japanese Americans were not on as a whole disloyal or have a propensity for disloyalty, as was alleged in the Supreme Court. So we needed a judicial declaration. We needed a counterweight to those arguments. So that was another really important, I think, part of our claim.
Welcome. And now, Lori Banai, welcome. I just wanted to say that Lori's wonderful book, Enduring Conviction, right here, I relied on heavily to write sections of this play, as well as Peter's book, Justice Delayed. I want to put in a plug for anyone listening to this panel to read these two books to, you know, get the actual facts of what happened and the actual history. But my question for you, Lori, is that these Coram Nobis cases may have taken place in the 1980s, but many say their cases, these cases and their ramifications have very powerful significance for our country today. And I would like to ask how you view the present day relevance of these cases to our current political situation, including the anti-Asian hostility and violence we're experiencing now, tragically, and Trump versus Hawaii.
Thank you so much, Jeannie, and thank you for this wonderful play and to LA Theater Works for producing it. I think the Coram Nobis cases can be viewed in a couple of different ways. As we've already talked about, it, along with the movement for redress that Dale just talked about, can be viewed as winning a measure of justice for the Japanese American community. And it was really significant for us, for our families and our community, for so many of the reasons that have already been discussed. But more broadly, of course, it can be viewed as one battle in a long war in this country against racism and intolerance and harming and scapegoating communities of color in this country, which is why Don and Dale and those of us continuing to talk about the incarceration continue to talk about it.
To hear more of our conversation, visit our website, latw.org. This is For Us All by Jeannie Sakata, directed by Annalise Erickson. For Us All is sponsored by the California Civil Liberties Public Education Program, a state-funded grant project of the California State Library. Starring Edward Asner, Brooke Ishibashi, Tess Lina, Mike McShane, Derek Mio, Joy Osmansky, Jeannie Sakata, Andre Soluzzo, Josh Stamberg, Greg Watanabe, and Paul Yen.
And you've been listening to For Us All by Jeannie Sakata.